Okay, so I guess it's my turn to take the hot seat here. The organizers asked me to coordinate a discussion on the subject of observables in quantum gravity and actually suggested the structure that I give a 30-minute presentation and then that can morph into 30 minutes of discussion. And so for the first 30 minutes, I'll give my presentation and have a focus actually on local observation. And then we can go ahead and discuss things as people wish beyond that. But because of this structure, I reserve the right to defer questions with long answers to the second half. Okay? So I'll be talking about some work done in collaboration with Don and Jim, and also a more recent paper with Michael Gary, a student here, sitting over there, and some passing reference to some other work I've done on my own, although the main focus will be on these first two papers. So what is the problem at hand? Well, the problem is how to describe local observation in a theory with quantum mechanics and gravity. Why should we care about this problem? Well, first, making contact with the subject of the workshop, singularities either are local phenomena, or if in a sense they are more than local, sort of global, they have various quite local features, BKL, etc., at least classically. And so likewise, you would expect that their resolution really is, in a sense, a local issue as well. Beyond the topic of the workshop, we should think about local observation because we would like to connect with more familiar physics, namely quantum field theory, where local observation plays a fairly central role in the formulation of the theory. When we try to do that, it turns out we appear to encounter some limitations. And the suggestion is that we should take those limitations seriously. We can view quantum mechanics as a guide. And one of the things that we learn from quantum mechanics is that unobservable features shouldn't be part of the theoretical framework. And here, the ultimate suggestion will be that one of the limitations has to do with locality and the possibility that it's not a fundamental aspect of the theory. Okay, so to explain the basic issue in a little bit more detail, so in all of physics with the exception of gravity, quantum field theory, we can describe local observables by writing down local gauge invariant operators. And, of course, these local gauge invariant operators are closely connected with what we really measure in quantum field theory. The key is that these do have to be gauge invariant, and in a theory with gravity, we don't know what the full gauge symmetry of the theory is yet. That's part of the problem of the workshop. But we're pretty sure it includes in some way diffeomorphism, certainly in the long-distance effect of theory. And so if you try to write down a local observable, just like in field theory, you discover you have a problem because any local expression will transform non-trivially under diffeomorphisms. And so, therefore, will not be gauge invariant unless it's just a constant or zero. So local operators can't be gauge invariant and therefore cannot be observables in reasoning going back to Dirac. And so one question you could ask then, once you encounter this tension between quantum field theory and gravity, is what observables should exist in a theory where you really have gravity and quantum field theory, and how do those reduce to local observables in quantum field theory in some limit? So the proposed resolution of this tension is via a relational approach, and the relational ideas have quite a long history Thomas referred to these in the context of loop quantum gravity, and there these ideas have taken some form. But really, they trace all the way back to writings of Einstein. DeWitt had some concrete things to say about these, and so, you know, about half the people in the room are on this list, and I probably forgot the other half. So, what's Leibniz? Well, okay. That's really, really going back. So a relational approach, it's pretty clear a lot of people have thought about, is sort of the right way of thinking about, well, closed systems like the universe, for example. But the focus here will be to take a relational approach, but also to ask this question, how do we get something that is local? And for a complete treatment of that, we presumably need a full description of the fundamental degrees of freedom of quantum gravity, which we don't yet know that we have. But the viewpoint I'll take here is that it should be possible to reconcile the gauge symmetry of gravity and local observation in the low energy effective theory, which is, you know, say Einstein's theory, plus perhaps higher dimension operators, and the small parameter that's describing the validity of this low energy effective theory is, well, or the collection of small parameters or momentum invariance in units of the Planck mass squared. So at least at this level, we should have some story about how this works. And what I'll also at least hint at here is that considerations about local observation in the low energy effective theory suggest limitations on the allowed degrees of freedom that should be part of the more fundamental theory. So the basic points of this talk will be that following a relational approach, one can write down diffeomorphism invariant relational observables. And these have the feature that in certain states, certain of these approximately reduce to the local observables of quantum field theory. And actually, I'll use the name quasi-local for these. Sorry, Don. Where's Don? I've decided pseudo is not as good of a word. Anyway. So,
we can debate semantics some other time.
Yes, we can. So today they'll be called quasi-local observables. And when you study locality and parameterize it in this fashion, there appear to be fundamental limitations to this locality that are basically implied by quantum and gravitational principles in general. Okay, so how do we think about this? Let me start by just giving a broad brush example. Some of you will be familiar with this kind of reasoning. This is not meant to be a fully complete implementation of these ideas, but I just want to explain the basic idea of how this works. So let's suppose we have some field theory with a local operator O, and let's suppose we have somehow four other fields in the theory working in four dimensions, four other fields, these ZIs, and let's suppose that we're in a state of the system, the universe or what have you, such that the ZIs have an expectation value that grows linearly with some coordinates. And then the basic idea is that if we're in such a state, we can define these quasi-local operators, which involve integrals of a delta function, or product of delta functions of the z's, setting the z's equal to some specific parameters that enter into the specification of the operator, times the local observable in question. So this is a diffeomorphism invariant expression, and it picks out the place in space where the z fields take on the given value. So this will have the effect of sort of localizing this operator. So just one other comment. You might think of this as a little bit like spontaneous breaking of diff symmetry or something like that, although actually you can realize this kind of thing, I would claim, in theories where you really are satisfying the constraints, so you're not literally breaking diff symmetry.
Right, the definition of the operator doesn't depend on the state psi?
No. No, it does not. Actually, I should also say, I put this in quotes, and that's because you know, we're talking about quantum field theory, and so we have to really, you know, think about how operators, composite operators like this are defined, and that's subtle business and depends on your renormalization and regularization and so on. So I'm just being schematic at this point, but I'll get more precise as we go. Okay, so here are two of the key formulas from the previous slide reproduced. And so just more specifically, how does this work? Well, if we take a product of these things with different size and look at the expectation value in this state, then you can see that, roughly speaking, these delta functions should localize each of the O operators at the relevant points specified by the psi parameters. So you should have an expression where this expectation value approximately reduces to product of the, we might have other aspects of the state, say the part that the operator O acts on, in which case we'd have an expectation value of a product of the local operators. So in this sense, we've localized. And so this is the basic idea for how it works. And the question is how to really implement it in a more careful fashion.
Is the state the solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation?
Well, at this point I'm being schematic, but I have in mind that yes, it certainly could be a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And we'll see a concrete example of a state that is, that realizes this kind of thing.
Because otherwise I would ask, maybe in another state, which is a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, would not get this.
No, actually, I have in mind things that solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I'm not really breaking diff invariants. This all should be a diff invariant framework.
So how does Z, whose expectation value is a monotonic function of X, is that a special thing, or is that something you can always...
Well, the general lesson would be that you can have solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Here I'm jumping ahead. But you can have solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation that have some feature. Okay, it may be, you know, the radius of the universe, or you know, some other features that there are different values for, and what you're doing is picking out the observable sort of conditioned on when you have, or when you're sitting on a particular feature, say the radius of the universe is such and such, or that kind of thing. So this is something that you imagine perhaps setting up in a limited region of space, and then the question of, you know, what happens when you really have a, you know, the full description of the universe and so on, and you know, how this actually works with the fields in our universe is more complicated. But we do think we have a solution essentially of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which has some features, galaxies that evolve, and planets and detectors and so on, and we can localize with respect to those features in the state, so to speak. That's the basic idea. So the linear evolution is just sort of a toy model of this more general approach.
And it doesn't even need to be monotonic.
Well, if it isn't monotonic, then yeah, you may be picking up more than one point. Mm-hmm. So you've got to, you know, choose the right kinds of things.
A good point to stress your general philosophy again, that the operator is whatever it is, but
yes,
it can only produce interesting results on certain states.
Exactly. That's a good point, which I will return to.
In order for this to work with psi, the solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, right?
Yes.
So psi is diffeomorphously demanded.
Yes.
So Zi should be kind of scaleless under diffeomorphisms. Is that right?
Well, no, this just should be a scalar quantity, this whole combined thing.
Right.
Yeah, scalar quantity integral. Although you could write down more complicated things. You could write down an integral, a double integral with a product, or you know, various other things.
Sure, but in this case, it should be, because otherwise...
Well, this whole thing should... The operator that you're integrating should be scalar.
Because otherwise, if psi is a diffeomorphism invariant...
Yes.
So I can just apply diffeomorphism on Bra and the Ket. Then the same as applying diffeomorphism on Z.
Oh.
And therefore, the right-hand side should be diffeomorphism invariant, and so Z should be diffeomorphism invariant. And there's no problem. I just wanted to...
That's not quite true that the only kinds of fields that can have vacuum expectation values are scalars.
No, but I think for non-scalar manipulator, there's like different expressions.
Yes, you would have to, yeah.
Yeah, Yes, there's a big difference.
Yeah, again, this is really just a toy model. And it's not even fully a toy model, but what I'm going to turn next to is a more full realization of a toy model.
And what does delta function of an operator mean here?
That's why there are quotes.
Oh, okay.
But you will see. Okay. So the precise explicit illustration of these ideas that I want to turn to is in the context of two-dimensional gravity, specifically two-dimensional Liouville gravity. And so let me just remind you how this works. We have some number of massless scalar fields. Let's let the number be C for historical reasons. And we can define the quantum theory via a functional integral where we integrate over metrics and fields. This is just the free action for the scalar fields. You all know what that is. And if we want to quantize this theory, we can use the fact that in two dimensions, gravity is almost trivial. Any metric can be written as a Weyl rescaling, well, up to a diffeomorphism can be written as a Weyl rescaling of a given background fixed metric, usually taken to be the trivial metric, but that depends on topology. And so if we perform this conformal gauge fixing, we can rewrite this functional integral in the form of an integral over the Liouville field, Weyl factor, and the massless scalar fields. And basically from this change of variables from here to here, more precisely from these measures, we pick up this Liouville action, which I've reproduced here, which includes a coupling to the background scalar curvature. So I have in mind this framework for setting gravity, and this has a long history, and string theorists have done a lot of work on it, I think. Well, also from non-string theory points of view, people have thought about it. And actually, I'm going to focus on the simplest case of this, which is C equals 25. And for C equals 25, you might say, well, this is all trivial because this term vanishes. But of course, we should make the kinetic term canonical by rescaling the field to get the C minus 25 out of it. And so if we do that, then we just end up with a C minus 25, actually the square root thereof, multiplying the curvature coupling. And so when C equals 25, that goes away. So we just have a free scalar field in that special case. And the things I'm going to say don't all necessarily depend on this. This is just the simplest example, and I want to keep things as clean and simple as possible. Okay, so for C equals 25, we have a free scalar, which I'll call X25, and the point will be that this furnishes a two-dimensional analog of this Z model that I was talking about earlier. So how does this work? Well,
what is the sign of the kinetic term that you kept for
five? It's the right sign. It's the same sign as the 25th. I mean, this is something I think most. Well, people who thought about Liouville gravity or who studied it closely appreciate is that in the limit when C equals 25, you just reproduce the bosonic string theory.
So it's a negative.
So, well, no, it's just like the 25th. It's the same sign as X24, X23, and so on.
So you have X naught was a separate.
X naught is, yeah.
Yeah, I thought, yeah. So your C equals 25 is the 26th dimensional bosonic string?
Yes. Yeah, that's the bottom line. So if you have 20, you have 25 scalar fields. And then the Liouville one becomes the 26th, and so you get out the bosonic string on the world sheet. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
If there's a way of shuffling around where phi becomes x naught, then
why? You could do it that way if you started with another. You could do it that way as well. Either way, you end up with the 26-dimensional world sheet theory of the bosonic string, and then you just have to change the identifications I'm about to talk about if you want to think about it that way. Okay, so let's try to construct an analog to this model that we described just a few minutes ago, And so let's take two of the scalar fields and imagine that those are the analogs of the Z fields. And then let's think about operators formulated using the remaining fields, x2 up through 24, not this one. And so the question is, how do I write down a state that does what I want, and how do I write down a quasi-local operator that does what I want? And I should say, this is everything I'm going to do here is textbook material. String theorists know this, but I just want to emphasize for the non-string audience, this is all textbook material, and one of the textbook authors is here, of course. Okay, so first the state. So how do I construct the state? Well, let's think about a space-time that's a cylinder, topologically, coordinates t and theta. And I'd like to construct a state such that the expectation value of x0 grows linearly with the t-coordinate, and the expectation value of x1 grows linearly with the theta coordinate. Since theta is periodic on the cylinder, I'd better have a periodic identification here. And for later use, I will focus on the case where r is big, although that's not necessary, at least not necessary for what I'm doing at this point. And of course, all of the string theorists will be falling asleep because they'll be saying, oh, this is just a winding state of the string, so what? Okay? Completely familiar setup. You can write down states that that have exactly these features. Now, the point being that these are states in the two-dimensional quantum gravity that satisfy the two-dimensional Wheeler-DeWitt equation, aka the Virasoro constraints. That's true, actually, if you have, well, you need a state of minimal excitation, so the vacuum. Also, there has to be a relationship between P0 and R, namely the so-called mass shell condition. But if you don't want to think about it in terms of target space, just think about this as some relationship between the field momenta of these two fields in two dimensions. Okay. So that's the state. Now for the operators. So let's start out with our operator that we'd like to localize. Let's suppose it's an operator with a definite conformal dimension, delta. And then we can write down a diff-invariant expression depending on some arbitrary momenta, which is the integral of that operator, and then e to the I k0 x0, and likewise for x1 and x25. And for string theorists, that's just the familiar vertex operator construction. And this operator will be diff-invariant if k25 is related to k0 and k1 by this condition, which in string theory is called the mass shell condition. And so the basic idea is we understand perfectly well how to compute expectation values of these operators in states like I've described. And what I'm going to do to localize is take that kind of object and Fourier transform it with respect to k0 and k1.
Is k25 always going to stay real?
Okay, good point. When you do that, this clearly looks complicated from this term. But if I Fourier transform with a sufficiently narrow wave packet, I'll show you the expression in a moment, but if I restrict to values of k that are sufficiently small, that's effectively not there. And I will do that. Okay, so again, there's the operator, and so we'll take a Fourier transform on k0 and k1 with a Gaussian parameter sigma, and then the appropriate phases that will lead to localization, and then this operator. And so the point is we have to take sigma, relatively big, at least of order 1, to avoid problems with that term that was just mentioned in the square root. And so we will do that. We'll take sigma to be big, or you might think of it as very big compared to 1, and then you shouldn't have a problem with that term. You're focusing on small k values not ones where that term is relevant. So, and this parameter that enters is actually related to the resolution that you can have, which we'll come back to. So these are are quasi-local observables. They depend on some variables, and the claim is that in this state they localize. And so how does that work? Well, if you...
So you're replacing the delta function now with some smeared out Gaussian...
Yeah, so that's the answer to David's question. Okay, I don't really want a delta function. That's a little too singular. It's a Gaussian.
Okay, great.
And it's a Euclidean Ka squared,
not Lorentzian. Well, Ka are all real, and so I really do have Gaussian suppression here. I haven't, well.
Summing the squares.
Summing the squares, yeah. Okay, so now let's write down, say, the expectation value of a collection of these operators in our state. And you can easily see that, from the momentum dependence of the operators and then the Fourier transform, you end up with an expression that involves Gaussians in time and position in two dimensions localized around these values that we put into our operators. This is just a slightly more careful version of the earlier argument. And so we have an integral with these Gaussians over the world sheet. And then there's some other function of the positions which doesn't sharply localize. This is the part that is localizing, and this doesn't spoil the localization. And then we have, of course, our operators, which we're trying to localize. And so this expression is something that really does produce something that is localized on the world sheet. This part of the operator that involves the so-called Z-fields, or X0 and X1, is producing, sharply peaked Gaussians, and you can take them to be more and more sharply peaked. We'll get back to that in a moment by taking P0 bigger and bigger, that tell you that you're localizing these operators on the world sheet. Okay, so they're localized, but they aren't perfectly localized. You don't have precise localization at a point. The precise resolution parameter is sigma over the field momentum in both directions. So there are limitations to the resolution, and those limitations, again, involve the field momentum. And just for the benefit of string theorists' intuition, let me connect this with something known. And that is, we're used to the idea that you can only localize in target space down to the string length, at least in the context of just dealing with strings. And so in target space, you can express that by saying we have a non-zero resolution parameter, or non-zero resolution of delta x. And if you think about that, and if you have a winding string, if you can resolve down to a resolution of, the string length in target space, and you take the radius of the circle to be larger and larger, that's going to localize more and more on the world sheet of the string. Okay, so it nicely corresponds to that. By taking the momentum or radius of the circle larger and larger, you localize better and better on the world sheet. Okay, so here you can localize arbitrarily well in two-dimensional gravity as you increase P0 and R. You can get arbitrarily fine resolution, and that's connected to the fact that 2D gravity is essentially trivial and also to conformal invariance. But you could ask, okay, if I tried to rerun the story in 4D gravity, what would the story be there? And there's clearly a problem if you increase field momenta, because field momenta getting larger leads to larger stress tensors, so there's a back reaction from that sourcing a large gravitational field. So there are clearly going to be limitations to this precision to which you can localize if you think about setting up something like this in four dimensions. So that suggests that there are basic limitations, and there are various ways of thinking about these, which I'm not going to get into the details of in this presentation, but there are a couple of the references. Okay, so let me finish just with some quick other comments. First of all, this again is to be thought of as an example, and there should be many generalizations of this. It's just a specific example of a general framework where you imagine having a background state that solves the constraints, is diff invariant, and for certain such states and certain operators, you can have operators that localize with respect to features of the state. Secondly, well, I've described construction of observables in the quantum mechanical sense, but what does that have to do with measurement? And the statement, which we discuss more in the paper with Don and Jim, is that for certain of these observables, again, in certain states, we can recover essentially recover Copenhagen measurement theory. So a nice measurement interpretation. But that's only in certain states. Finally, how...
Are you going to say what you mean by Copenhagen measurement?
Ooh, I smell a trap. Yes, yes, that has a lot. That is not a...
Such questions to Jim.
That's right. Jim will answer. Sorry, Jim. No, actually, he's written papers. Save for the discussion. Okay, so what about string theory? How might this work? Well, we have two approaches to thinking about non-perturbative string theory. One is string field theory. And so you might think about how this could work in the context of string field theory. And, of course, string field theory has a very powerful and complicated set of gauge symmetries. And those are going to constrain the kinds of gauge invariants that you can write down. One proposal is, say, if this is the string field action for the closed string, roughly speaking, you could take, say, the first derivative of it. And if you think about the expansion of this in terms of the string field, there's a cubic term multiplied by g and then quartic terms and so on. And so this would, in a sense, pick off the cubic term, and that can actually play the role of a quasi-local observable of a slightly different kind, which we describe in the paper with Don and Jim under the heading the psi squared phi model. In certain states, those things localize as well. Another approach to string theory, obviously, that has been discussed is ADS-CFT, and you might say, well, gee, how should it work there? That's a very interesting question, but it's been some discussion in particular about how local data on scales small as compared to the ADS radius are encoded. Let's assume that they are encoded somehow in ADS-CFT. And the expectation based on the UVIR correspondence is that somehow that data has to be encoded in relational observables in the n by n matrix. Okay, so just to summarize, we can recover local observables of quantum field theory in a relational approach if we start out with specific operators, but also if only in certain states. Such reconciliation of observation and diff invariance we can explicitly illustrate in 1+1-dimensional quantum mechanical frameworks. But there are general limits to such locality, both from quantum effects, which we've really seen a manifestation of, but also from gravitational effects you would expect in higher dimensions. And so the suggestion, again in the spirit of quantum mechanics, is that these should point to fundamental limitations to local dynamics in quantum gravity. So that's the end of the presentation part. So the floor is open for discussion, or maybe questions. Helms.
You said at the start that singularities presumably require a local mechanism of resolution. Doesn't your work suggest that we should look for a non-local mechanism?
Well, certainly there should be some connection with local concepts because singularities, again, have local features, and how the space-time is getting singular one place may differ from how it is getting singular another place. So, they are things that are, have local structure, and so there should be some approximation in which you can describe what's going on there with reference to local structure. I mean, moreover, if you think about Well, if you think about singularity resolution in at least one favorite context, which is black hole singularities, you know, you really kind of have to think about that in terms of local physics, because you can never see the singularity. It's inside the horizon. You have to describe the observer who's falling in, the local observer falling in, and you'd have to somehow talk about what that observer sees if you want to try to describe things in terms of the observables.
But that's not in that local. It was any observer which falling in will see the singularity. So from that point of view, it's very long local because it's a
no. Okay, but careful. Any observer who is falling in is somewhat local.
Right. Just say. Oh, just.
Okay.
It's a
that's all I mean.
Time, but another space local.
Yeah. Space local. Right. If I'm falling in, I'm falling in. I'm not out at Alpha Centauri.
But every observer falling in can see the singularity.
I know, but not every observer is falling in, so that's the point.
Steve might like to say that one needs a quasi-local observer to study.
Well, or you need something that's localized to within the Schwarzschild radius. Okay.
Well, yeah. One solar mass is a lot bigger than one comet mass, so that's not quite so bad.
So, actually, oh, well, Eva, go ahead.
Well, I'm not sure that this the center between 2D and higher D gravity will necessarily be as bad as you're saying, because there are some ways of holographically dualizing, for example, the Sitter space to obtain a field theory plus gravity in lower dimensions. The most recent attempt along these lines is Susskind and collaborators, but there's an even simpler way of viewing it as a Randall Sundrum-like system. And then you can keep holographizing the gravity down to two dimensions.
Well, it's a nice idea.
The flip side of that is that the bulk gives them some very complicated field theory.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's, you know, your point about ADS-EFT that needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
How you localize it in the bulk.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting, again, that and ADS-CFT is a really interesting way to try to think about it. And the problem is understanding how to set up something that looks local on some scale, but then isn't really local in some sense. And how to reconcile that with the effect of field theory, which also looks local in some regimes, but may not be local.
Yeah,
or the right
all
local,
the with
the right description.
So. Part of the story.
Okay, I see. Oh, so there may, yeah, so a more direct connection, potentially, if you can understand, so to speak, how to decode the hologram. That's sort of the crux matter.
That's
the ADS-CFT. Well, I mean, related to that, a more direct connection is just, you know, 4D gravity with a couple of Killing fields, right? Then we know we can dimensionally reduce, and we can recast Einstein's equation as a two-dimensional gravity plus matter field. Equivalent classically to the four-dimensional theory with a little bit of symmetry.
Well, not when you include the fluctuations, though. Right? The fluctuations don't necessarily have to be symmetric. So that's, but yeah, anyway, yeah, and there, of course, there are toy models for gravity, which come via that route. But that's one of the general concerns is the fluctuations. So. Steve.
The observable you construct in 2D gravity, is there some way and some limit of thinking of finding a saddle point where you actually like use the strings to pick out a point on the world on the 2D plane? I have in mind these old, or is it Mende?
Yeah, these high energy scatterers.
Yeah, where there you actually pick out a preferred point on the Riemann surface and see this locality kind of happening.
I mean, that's basically what this is.
Is there a saddle point as you take your sigma to zero or whatever your saddle point parameter, where you actually, instead of having an integral formula, you can see the thing is dominated by points.
Yeah. I think there should be a saddle point approximation directly to the expression I wrote down.
And then you'll actually see the thing sitting at points.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I don't think it's much beyond the formula I actually wrote down to see that.
But in the formula, you're formally integrating.
No. Yeah, the Gaussian is what's giving you the saddle point approximation. Yeah, so just do a saddle point approximation to this, and here's your, you know, what gives you your saddle.
It just sits there.
Yeah.
And the only thing is that this is diffeomorphism.
Yeah. You might worry, you know, if these things get too singular, they could spoil the saddle point, spoil the localization. And so there are actually, you know, there are various technical details which are all spelled out.
So does it happen when you hit the thing with a diff generator? Why is it not? How does it work? You might be moving the point formally.
Yes. Yes.
And that gets canceled against what?
Okay. Well, let's just think about translations. And actually, there's another subtlety that I have not spelled out because of the limited time. But actually, what you do here is you localize points, well, separations between points.
Right.
So you have some definite value for this, this, and this.
Right.
And you're not localizing in an absolute sense. And that's actually connected to the fact that, you know, the usual story on the sphere, you always fix three points to fix SL2R. This is that. This one's that. And then you can fix one more, which corresponds to the translation symmetry here.
So if somehow we hadn't been so unlucky and gravity had turned out to be renormalizable, then we would have been able to think of gravity as a massless spin 2 field on flat space and diffeomorphism invariance as just a, you know, more complicated gauge invariance. Would we still be forced to do things like that, or would we, you know, then have local observables in exactly the same way that we do gauge invariant observables in QED?
No, I think it has to do with the, it's not necessarily the renormalizability that is central here, right? Again, we were discussing things in the low energy effective theory, and I didn't even say any words about the renormalizable structure or not of the theory. It has to do with how the diffs act and the fact that, you know, by definition, anything that is local is acted on non-trivially by the gauge symmetry, which is a diff.
But if I adopt, the point of view of Weinberg's relativity textbook and just say, look, you know, forget about all this geometry nonsense. You just have a massless spin 2 field on flat space, and you know, its gauge group is just this.
Good.
You know, then what goes wrong with that point of view?
Well, okay, so you have to write down things that are gauge symmetric, so diffeomorphism invariant. And let's think about how you do that in gauge theory. In non-abelian gauge theory, you have things like trace of F squared or what have you, right? And so this trace is sort of summing over the gauge indices, and that's kind of like doing the integral. So the problem is, well, gee, you could just follow that line and write down all kinds of things that are formally diff invariant, but how do you get things that are local? And that's what this is supposed to be the answer to. It's that the sort of the indice, the analog of, well, let me not take, let me just leave it at that unless there's more specific. Jorge.
Do you have some more thoughts, perhaps more informal, about fundamental limits in 4D?
Yes.
Yeah, what is that? How big a scale? Are you talking about Planck scale sort of limits, or much bigger?
I don't know. I could say more about it. But no, it looks like the limitations actually, in certain cases, are on much larger scales. And there are various illustrations of that which I referred to along the lines of, well, there's this, this locality bound idea and these instrumentation bounds. And yeah, I guess I could try to attempt to describe those more, but let me give just a super quick description, and then if people want more details, I can attempt to supply. But in order to get this localization to work, one might have objected, well, gee, you know, basically, for, even in the Z model, fluctuations can't be too big in the field you're trying to localize with respect to. So then you ask, okay, in the context of gravity and 4D, if I'm trying to localize, when do fluctuations get big and what kind of restrictions do I get from that? And for example, if I'm trying to localize, say, a large number of things in a given region, gravitational fluctuations can get big, in a sense, or at least gravity gets strong when I form a black hole. And likewise, even if you're trying to localize, say, two quanta, at, say, positions X and Y. And if these are sufficiently high energy quanta, then likewise the gravitational back reaction gets strong. And so you also encounter a limitation there to this kind of prescription for localization. So that's the rough idea in outline.
That's a, you kind of mentioned this in the beginning. There's some models that were worked out in the older relativity literature. And some of them are like what Gary just told us about symmetric reduction. And
symmetric, these. Mm-hmm.
But then, so what happened, so like the so-called Einstein-Rosenberg, for example, Martin Luther.
Your
point about, you know, the fluctuations are not symmetric is well taken, and this analysis does not address that point. So think of this just as a, just like you did that look, two-dimensional gravity.
Yeah, exactly. I was when you said that. Yeah. Well, or two-dimensional. I mean, let's take dilaton gravity just because that's the one I understand the best.
What worked out where of this kind? Three-dimensional gravity coupled with matter field.
Well, three I have less intuition for. Can we do it in two?
Well, let Avi make his point.
Okay.
So there, I mean, the point that you are asking about is localization. So I think, so what happens is basically that if you try to localize, you have these Gaussians, and you have to start worrying about, I mean, okay, let me start from back. In order to localize, we're putting these Gaussians there, right? Exactly. So then we have to worry about, they were kind of rather sharply peaked at some momentum, because they were, but in the momentum space also there might be some Gaussians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I had in mind here. Yeah.
And then one has to exactly start worrying about even the tail terms near the Planck scale, because the fluctuations can be exponential. And I have not really looked at it from this point of view, that the way that you're looking at it now. I mean,
well, yeah.
So it's good to sort of go back to that all these older models.
Yeah.
And worry about, you know, what does it tell you about localization? It's just done from some other perspective, not from the perspective of localization.
I tend not to worry about those because you can take things to be of compact support, probably to eliminate tail terms. Is that agrees with your intention?
Yeah, that won't change the measure. No, but compact support in space. These are supposed to be the tail terms in the momentum space.
That's you could take them compact.
You can take compact support.
Yeah, that.
But then you will not get much localization here, right? Because
it's
compact.
No.
Anything which is compact in momentum space by Fourier transform is completely non-local in the position space.
It can be localized, can't it?
Non-local, you just have some tail.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, some small tail.
Now we exactly talk about, you know, worry about what you mean by localization. How much is that tail?
That's right.
Yeah.
So this is exactly what I'm saying.
That's right.
But this is what one would have to worry about. So they do. Yeah. Exactly. What more precisely formulating localization in space.
Sure.
So this is very nice because one can go back. These models were worked out and they're sitting there, so we can just go back and analyze these issues.
So which models again then? It's
these were basically so-called Einstein and Rosen waves.
Okay.
And also it's actually some of the
the Gaudi space times are the ones you want to look at if you want to apply to singularity resolution.
Right. And one polarized Gaudi models.
Yeah. I mean they have a singularity and they have the sort of local BKL behavior except without the Bixmaster stuff. So it's just, you know, a nice simple Kasner but local type approach. Velocity term dominated, but as Gary says, because there are two symmetries, that means everything is really, you know, just depends on, you know, one space coordinate at a time. Mm-hmm. So it should be amenable to these two-dimensional field theory approaches.
Yeah. Okay.
Gaudier is going to be easier to analyze than Einstein-Rosen waves with this kind of technology due to a reason that Steve, the fact that Steve didn't mention is didn't emphasize, which I wonder if I can say just a minute about because it's interesting.
It's a discussion.
Sure. So as Steve was saying, the reason you have to worry about gravitational back reaction I mentioned is that he saw in his model that in order to get good resolution to measure things precisely, you needed a large field momentum. And so if there's a large field momentum filling up the space-time, or filling up some large region of space-time, that tends to have a lot of energy and cause a lot of gravitational back reaction. In a high-dimensional analog of Steve's case, a compact spatial topology, you find that if you don't want to keep the gravitational back reaction small, you have to limit your field momentum in some way associated with the total volume of the universe. You can't have too much integrated energy or else the back reaction will become large. So it tells you that, in fact,
these kind of techniques have a certain limitation. For a given finite-sized universe, you can only get a certain amount of resolution, at least uniformly, over that universe. And so, in fact, in the case where you try to work with a especially non-compact space-time, there's a tendency to get certain infrared divergences out of this procedure. That is, certainly, you can't put any fixed field momentum at uniform density over that space-time, or you'll have infinite back reaction.
Yeah. Yeah, that's related to these instrumentation bounds.
It's related to the
let me just mention there's this notion of, I think, an ultimate detector. And I don't know, have people heard of this ultimate computer of Seth Lloyd's? Okay, one person has. You know, how good could you get the ultimate laptop, actually? Something that weighs a pound and, you know, sits in your lap. What's the best computational ability that you can achieve with that? And there are quantum limitations to that. So so there's a notion, I think, of an ultimate detector, and that is... Oh, sure. Yeah, that if you try to resolve things within a given region at a given resolution, you encounter exactly these kinds of limitations. For example, you need to excite fields with a given momentum to get to increase the momentum to get the resolution finer and finer. And if you do that, and if you're really able to sort of measure things everywhere in your volume, then you're going to have an energy that grows with the volume, and also as you decrease improve the resolution. And ultimately, you run into the statement that you will have a large gravitational back reaction because the thing, you know, forms a black hole, so to speak. So that's at least part of the story there. So, yeah, Steve.
Well, I mean, so in string theory, as you know, there's two different kinds of lengths. There's a string length and a Planck length.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when you take the string coupling to zero, you can let the Planck length go to zero, but the string length is still there.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you feel about, I mean, how strong a limit does just the string length impose on resolving features? I mean, are we able to resolve various kinds of gravitational features like singularities arbitrarily well? Finite string length with zero Planck length?
Well, yeah, there's an interesting story, and this connects to this whole high energy scattering story.
Mm-hmm.
String theory can place limitations, but I think let me see. What's the best way of saying it? String theory can, well, it, one or the other can serve as the fundamental limitation for the shortest distance. But actually what we're talking about here is even resolution, in larger and larger volumes and infrared effects. So limitations on resolution over large scales. And actually that's more the question I'm focusing on here, in a sense. And the limitations to resolution on large scales look to me, based on high energy scattering, like they're gravity dominated, not string dominated. And that's a whole nother talk, basically, which you've heard part of.
But earlier about how, I guess we should call it ultraviolet localization, of how precisely you can talk about a local operator and stuff.
Yeah, so if you try to talk about something more and more localized, then you start producing something with higher and higher momentum.
Right.
And, you know, if you take that to the limit where you're trying to sort of infinitely localize it, it's a question of what gets you the growth of size of strings or the growth of size of black holes, so to speak.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at, I have a number of agendas here, some conscious and some unconscious.
But, okay. We all do.
do you expect singularities, you know, big bangs, big crunches, black hole singularities, could they be resolved just by stringy effects, if G string is equal to zero? Like, is it possible that the fuzziness of strings could possibly smear these things out without having to worry about...
Can a non-string theorist ask you to clarify the question first? I mean, if G string is zero, doesn't that mean there's no gravity?
Yes, but strings can still be.
So there's no gravitational singularity. So what's the question?
There could be classical gravity.
Yeah.
You can find a classical background in G3 equals.
Yeah, but.
In fact, Steve was saying your mass is getting really big.
Yeah.
In some units, so that you keep the back reaction. Your initial mass, which is collapsing, is getting bigger and bigger as you tune down Newton's constant, so that you keep the black hole still there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Such a thing can be constructed in a simpler way.
Yeah.
Broadly, can there be no examples where it is just resolved that way, just orbital?
Right. So there are some. There are
some very special. Yeah,
well, so that's a question.
How special
are these? The kinds of examples that we've been bandying around the past 3 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good question. My feeling is there may be an issue there because when I think about it in terms of, say high energy scattering and in particular black hole formation, somehow you need some resolution that is not just at the singularity, but something else happening all the way out to the horizon.
Yeah, and I guess there's a question of how that's related to the singularity. There's a bunch of issues.
Anyway, but I don't have a simple answer, is the short answer.
There's a curious similarity with this in loop quantum gravity kind of idea also. So, center. This is a Planck length. And to begin, there's also what we call the area gap, the minimum eigenvalue of area. But of course, if you calculate in area units, it's some number, delta, times Planck length squared.
Right.
But we can just look at this delta by itself. In many formulae, Planck length doesn't appear, just the number delta appears.
If you take. It's a numerical constant times the Planck length, right?
Yes.
So it's not, they're not independently adjustable.
No.
So they sort of are. You have this Amirtzi parameter.
Oh, I see. So you mean this would be a limit where the Amirtzi parameter went to infinity.
For example, or something.
That has bad other effects.
But why don't I get very carefully in this limit? Because if you do it in the beginning, then the theory just collapses. But in the final results, one can take these limits independently. And we're quite interested in what happens. And so, for example, if I keep the Planck length, so I don't take h bar to zero.
Yeah.
But I take this area, this delta parameter go to zero. And then these various difference equations we have, that they just become differential equations like the relativity equation. And then in fact the singularities are not resolved in this limit.
Can you solve that? This is an issue. Can you solve this? Does the theory become simple in a limit where the Amirtzi parameter is very large and very small? I mean, is there some
very small we can understand, very large, I don't have anything.
Well, obviously, that's a limit that's more soluble.
Right, exactly. Very small.
It's not just classical GR. It's something else.
No, it's not. That's the point. It's more like the relativity equation. It's like the continuum limit. The discreteness effects of geometry go away.
But
there is still h bar in it, which like.
I see. And other than these simple mini superspace equations, can you solve the whole theory in that limit?
No, only in some models we can do it. But I just wanted to sort of say that there is a. There's somewhat analog that I would like to
think. What the black hole entropy goes to infinity, or which way does the black hole entropy go in this case?
Black hole entropy would go to infinity.
Sounds like a possible.
But Planck length is finite, but the black hole entropy, so you have an infinite number of degrees of freedom per Planck area or volume.
Well, it's the large mass limit, is another way of saying it.
Is it large mass, or it's large? No,
I think
it's
just a fixed area.
Like we normalize, Planck scale goes to zero, is that right? Can I think of renormalized Planck scale goes to zero?
Renormalized Planck scale?
Right. Yeah, just can I imagine that there's no quantum fluctuation in that limit? So gamma goes to zero, is there a quantum gravitational fluctuation?
Like I was saying, it's like the you get something like the relativity equation. So the relativity equation has quantum fluctuations.
I think that's much more interesting than the question I was thinking about. having a dimensionless parameter is a good thing. That's like in string theory, having a dimensionless G-string is good, but I hadn't thought about the fact that the Amirtzi parameter is like that.
I know that Steve, you have said something like in the Solvay meeting that in favor of the gauge fixing, you were sort of talking about that. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I do remember that.
So
I had a particularly awkward way of saying it, but yes.
But would this Is this something like this? What you had in mind is that in favor of gauge fixing. It is gauge fixing.
Well, actually, this is like talking about Wilson loops, if you will, finding the gauge invariant way of probing something. I would be more saying fix Coulomb gauge and put in two static sources. Mm-hmm. So I think my comment was about something much more primitive than that.
But you could map, in some sense, one onto the other.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
I mean, these should have some gauge fixed representation where they may be sometimes simpler.
Right.
Yeah, when gauge fixing based on these extra z degrees of freedom is a valid thing to do, the decryption of these becomes manifestly null.
Right.
But you can talk about these observables even in context where that gauge fixing is not obviously a valid thing.
Right, but then we cannot talk about localization.
You can ask the question of how localized things are, and you usually find out that they're not very localized.
Well, not as localized as you would like.
Not as localized.
So, yeah.
Yeah, no, this is more done, so that's
fine. Veronica.
Out on a limb question. Given these frequent limitations and how much you can measure, is it clear that things like the information paradox are still well posed?
No. Yeah, certainly have thoughts on that, but it's, well, the time's getting short, so.
Saved by the bell.
Yes.
Okay, so maybe, you know, we should stop now. Thanks, see you again.